Are we recording? I think we're probably recording. Let's just go with it.
Yeah.
Mel Hummer Podcast 134. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show. I am Mel from Metal Hammer. Joining me today is Metal Hammer Reviews Editor and Guardian of the Underground, Mr. Jonathan Seltzer. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good.
That is good to hear. Also joining me is one of our very finest freelancers and a lovely man, Mr. Stephen Hill. How are you, Steve?
Just had a nice bun. So, yeah, real good.
Lovely. Good. Glad to hear it. Don't forget, the latest issue of Metal Hammer is out right now. It's got Corey Taylor on the cover. We're doing his, quite frankly, batshit insane solo album for Album of the Week a bit later. We talked to him about that amongst a ton of other things. We also have some very special Corey Taylor bundles coming very soon. So keep your eye out on metalhammer.com and all our socials for more news of that. If you're a big Corey Taylor fan, you're going to want it. Trust me on that. Let's get stuck straight into the news this week, shall we? I was kind of just a bit bummed out by the latest Fear Factory update, to be honest. A band who were at one point one of the single greatest things in heavy music. So vital, so influential. And it just seems as the years have gone on, this whole situation in that band has gone to shit more and more. And now Burton C. Bell, the co-founding member and vocalist throughout the history of the band, has now quit. This all comes after years of legal turbulence involving various members. And despite guitarist Dino Cazares saying a new Fear Factory album was coming next year, Burton's put out a big statement, quite a dramatic statement, which you can read in full, I think, on his socials or over at metalhammer.com. I mean, this is just sad, isn't it, to see what a once great metal institution has become in 2020.
Yeah, I think it's a really good warning to bands now about the splitting up and just not going back, to be honest. They say never go back, don't they? And to be fair to Fear Factory, when they did reform, or those two original members reform, because it was never Raymond Herrera who was the drummer, and I don't think it was Christian, the sort of, that was the classic lineup of Fear Factory, wasn't it? Even though they had a different bass player originally. They released some pretty good albums, and they were all right live. I mean, considering Burton's got a bit of a reputation of, how can we politely put this, not quite being able to pull off a lot of those vocal tricks he does on the record in the live setting, Fear Factory were pretty good. They were pretty good. But, I mean, now in 2020, is anyone kind of clamoring for new Fear Factory? What is their standing? What is their reputation? I mean, I can't help feeling that they'd be much better thought of and their reputation would be better if they'd have just sort of split up and remained split up. Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of bands, but I genuinely do kind of feel that sometimes you just should leave it, really.
Yeah. Do you think they're one of those bands where if they'd kind of just split kind of near the turn of, and I agree with what you said about some of those latter albums. I know kind of their 90s output. If anyone listening isn't very primed on Fear Factory, for fuck's sake, go listen to Demanufacture. It has influenced so much of what has come since. But there is great stuff in the noughties as well. I love the Mechanized album.
Yeah.
The Archetype album is a great album as well. That was kind of after they had a bit of a lineup change. So there's some really good stuff there. But do you think they could have been one of those bands where if they just kind of not bothered, their kind of legacy might have grown and we might have seen them come back to kind of be a big deal in the metal scene again?
Yeah, I mean, they were like really important in the 90s. I mean, I used to go and see them. I remember seeing them at the Underworld, and I used to write about them in the 90s for my first magazine, Melody Maker. But you kind of wonder, but I mean, not only were they really influential, but also they kind of brought like an influence from other things into the metal scene. So they were really heavily influenced by Godflesh. And I remember like seeing it, like Godflesh on, like seeing Fear Factory and Godflesh and Killing Joke all on stage at one gig at the Astoria, rest in peace. And it was just an amazing chain of influence, because you would have had no Godflesh without Killing Joke. You'd have had no Fear Factory without Godflesh. So they brought these kind of industrial sensibilities into metal. And that was really important. I kind of wonder, like, how much Fear Factory's stuff would date if they came back, because they were tied into like one particular kind of industrial sound, which is very much of its time. And I wonder what a new album would sound like in 2020 or 2021. You know, they always had to kind of keep having these concepts of what technology is doing to us. And you could maybe, as good as the more recent albums were, you could sense the concepts becoming a little bit more forced. And they're kind of like stuck to what their Fear Factory were about. Mm. Not to take away from it how great I always used to think they were.
Yeah, I remember going to see them live a few years ago and somebody behind me shouted, "Do the one about the robots," and everyone just sort of laughed. That's all of them. Yeah, I mean, the concept, especially at this point where, I mean, we are basically living in that dystopian future that they were talking about in a lot of respects now. So, yeah, I think it's very difficult to look at Fear Factory and not feel like they have or would be dated in many, many ways. I mean, what's quite interesting, what you said, Jonathan, without Killing Joke, there'd be no Godflesh. Without Godflesh, there'd be no Fear Factory. Arguably, without Fear Factory, there'd be no new metal. So are you calling Godflesh and Killing Joke the godfathers of new metal?
Godflesh have been called the forefathers of new metal.
I actually
did the sleeve notes for the reissue of one of their records, and I kind of mentioned that there was a link between them and new metal. So very much so.
Amazing.
There you go. Fred Durst, hand over all of your royalties to Justin Broderick now.
But it's funny how these things work. It was Street Cleaner, like their classic album, and I was really honored to do the sleeve notes, and I did like a big 1,000-word essay on that record, but talking about where they came from, about the whole dub aspect, but also like that whole groove aspect, how it kind of fed into new metal, whether directly or indirectly. So what a wonderful world chain of influences and connections we live in.
So, yeah, man, you would say that the Union Underground did take that formula and refined it to its...
But as for Fear Factory, I mean, it's funnily enough, weirdly, before this news broke about a week ago, I stuck Denying Your Factor on. It's still an absolutely great record. And it still does... I still think that as good as those latter albums were, and, you know, they've released some pretty good records since that record. They've released some pretty bad records since that record. That one really does stand out as clearly comfortably the best one. I think Soul of a New Machine's really good as well. I, like most people of my age, have got a bit of a love for Obsolete as well. I'm sure Merlin's about to rep for... what was the one that came out? The big one.
Digimortal, yeah.
Yeah,
that's got a really bad rep. I actually like it more than the general reputation it's got.
Yeah, it's a good album. It's just, I think they kind of just tried to go proper new metal, and I can see why people were against it. But I wouldn't say it's on the level of Obsolete, certainly not on the level of Demanufacture.
Yeah, yeah. But they actually sound, I don't know, I'd be interested to hear what a younger metal fan who's sort of grown up with the last 10, 12 years of metal would make of Demanufacture, because I can't unhear it from hearing it when I was a kid, and I just sort of... predisposed to loving it, but I do still listen to it and think that probably sounds a little bit dated at this point. And I think Fear Factory in general probably sound a little bit, I mean, like, you know, we were talking about Deftones the other week, and Deftones still manage to sound kind of contemporary, whereas there's not really anything about Fear Factory that sounds contemporary to me. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I know that obviously Burton's kind of gone back to his Ascension of the Watchers project, which he's had kind of going on and off for years and years now. So it'll be interesting to see what that sounds like, and whether that will kind of represent something that does sound a bit more timely, and, you know, whether he's taking on board more modern influences, because it's probably quite hard for Fear Factory to do that. But it's a shame that they haven't been able to do that, because you kind of, you know, I'd love to see what a kind of rejuvenated Fear Factory that's got a slightly different outlook, and, you know, a different kind of production team behind it, bringing in new influences. I mean, you look at a band like Code Orange, and like, there's plenty of those kind of elements that Fear Factory put down on that album. So it's kind of like the ingredients are still relevant, but yeah, you're probably right. They haven't been produced in a way that feels violent and cutting edge for a good while now. But we'll see what happens anyway. Dino's still saying there's new Fear Factory coming next year. So whether that's old stuff or a new singer, fuck knows what will happen there. To make things more contemporary, AC/DC are coming back. I'm generally happy about this. Like, one of those things where there's so much shit going on and there's so much bad news everywhere, And I know that a new AC/DC album is just going to sound like another AC/DC album, but fucking hell, man. AC/DC with Brian Johnson back in the band. I'm happy. I think it's cool.
I'm very happy about this. I really like Black Ice. I want AC/DC to sound like AC/DC, nothing else.
Definitely. I should say as well that this is all rumors, by the way. Like, I wish I got intel into AC/DC. The only person who seems to have intel is Dee Snider, according to Twitter. But there's no official kind of thing yet saying what's happening. But they're coming back. There's social media posts going out. They've reactivated a new website. There's posters popping up outside Angus's old high school. And there's been rumors of Brian Johnson being back in the band for about a year now. So, I mean, I'm banking on it happening. Like, feel free to call me up for being an idiot if it all turns out to be an elaborate hoax, but I'm pretty sure it isn't.
Yeah, it's just every time you hear AC/DC, it's just, you just get the same feeling all over again. It's just like, it's always like the first time you've ever heard them. It's just like, I have one friend who doesn't like AC/DC. And when she mentioned this to me, I was just like, my whole world, I had to like reconfigure my world around this. It's like hating your own heartbeat.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's inside of you.
Like, I love AC/DC. I fucking love AC/DC. But again, I don't want to sound like I'm going to sound like a right misery this week. But without Malcolm, I feel kind of weird about with it without Malcolm Young. He is that heartbeat you're talking about, Jonathan. He is such an integral part, and I think, although people will go, hey, Brian's back, and although people will look at Angus as in, you know, he's the sort of the most recognisable member, something feels kind of off to me with thinking about AC/DC without Malcolm Young. It just feels sort of off to me a bit. And, like, I want to get excited about it. And ultimately, like, I'm sure if and when, I mean, you know, imagine when gigs come back and we're allowed to have normal gigs again, and one of the first gigs you go to is fucking AC/DC. Like, imagine how many livers are going to be decimated.
That would be the perfect band just to come back to, just like feel everything's all right with the world. And but I don't think AC/DC are going to put out a record that's not calibrated to maximum AC/DC-ness. You know, this thing about them, it's the same with like Maiden. With AC/DC, it's like there's so many bands who sound like them, you know, want to be them, and what either of those bands do isn't rocket science, but no one else can do it. You know, no one has got that kind of absolute perfect calibration where everything kind of fits in together, and there's some kind of weird magic that's not rocket science, but it's just no one else can do it but AC/DC. There's so many AC/DC type bands, there's so many Maiden type bands, and yet they can't do what those two bands do.
Well, I agree with that. But then, I mean, you are taking a massive part of the chemistry out of that if you take Malcolm Young out of it. And so I'm just approaching it from new material-wise, a little bit of trepidation. I actually think the last couple of AC/DC albums have been pretty good. I mean, obviously, I know we're talking about one that came out 5 years ago and one that came out 12 years ago. But, you know, so they're few and far between, but they've been pretty good the last couple, I think. Far better than they've got any right to be. And really, you want three songs off that are absolute ragers to go into that live set with, you know, arguably one of the greatest back catalogues of music that anyone has ever produced, certainly guitar music. And yeah, but I don't know, man. I don't know. Like, you're right. A lot of people sound like AC/DC, but then Phil Rudd, Malcolm Young, such a big part of the chemistry of that. So, I'm going to try not to get too excited.
But Malcolm wasn't on... I don't think Malcolm was on the last album either, was he?
I think he was. He wasn't on the tour, but I think he would have been involved in the writing of it.
I'm just looking it up on now. I'm Wikipedia-ing this shit. Rock or Bust was the group's first album without founding member and rhythm guitarist Malcolm Young, because he co-wrote the album. Yeah, okay, so that's what matters. And he didn't form it, but he co-wrote it. So yeah, I mean, when I last saw AC/DC, in fact, the only time I've seen AC/DC, Malcolm wasn't on stage. Stevie, I think it's his nephew, isn't it, was playing. Mm-hmm. And it was still an amazing thing. I mean, I think really with AC/DC, like, obviously, it's great to have a new album, but as kind of you guys have talked about, it's about those live gigs, isn't it? Like, the kind of essence of celebratory rock music made flesh. that's what I think I'm most excited about. I'll be interested to hear what the album sounds like, but I think it's all kind of just, you know, something of a formality in terms of getting the band back on stage and out on a world tour again, which hopefully we'll find out more about very soon. I mentioned this last week, but don't forget that Metal Hammer and Prog are teaming up with the mighty Enslaved for an exclusive streaming event celebrating the release of their brand new album, Utgard, that's out on Friday. The streaming event kicks off tomorrow, Thursday, October 1st at 7 p.m. BST. If you want to get involved in that, full details are on the Metal Hammer website right now. As we said, there is a new Enslaved album out. We'll probably talk about that in a little bit, but we have to really... for album of the week, talk about the debut solo album by Mr. Corey Taylor of Slipknot and Stone Sour fame. He's on the cover of this month's issue of Metal Hammer. It came almost inexplicably the first time he's ever done a solo album. It just doesn't seem possible, but it is. And it is... I don't even know where to start with this album. I mean, this album is what it is, isn't it? Corey Taylor has basically spent the last 2 years putting everything he's got into kind of the just chaos of Slipknot and a lot of stuff into Stone Sour as well, of course. And now he's basically just decided to go, I like loads of this other stuff as well, so I'm just going to have a laugh and make an album of stuff like that. And that's basically what he's done. Fair to say?
Well, the thing is, it doesn't sound like a debut album. It sounds like the 10th album by a middling blues rock modern country musician who's just stopped caring. it cuts across so many different kind of genres. Like, but the way it goes from like say the opening HWY 666 to the next song, just like there's nothing really binding them other than like as any kind of artistic statement. Other than yeah, I just kind of like this stuff.
That's exactly it though, isn't it? It's not really like this is the sound of Corey Taylor, like this is what Corey Taylor sounds like as a solo artist. It's literally like, here's stuff I listen to and I like. I should say as well that like Dave Everly, who reviewed it in the magazine, really liked the record. He gave it an 8 out of 10. He totally vibes with the just kind of party atmosphere that the album goes with. Like, I don't deeply dislike this album. I just think it's impossible to get a kind of hook into it because, as you said, it's just so all over the place. Like, there's bits where it's a kind of like arena rock, Black Eyes Blue, which I think he released already. Obviously, there's like the rap metal kind of Five Finger Death Punch vibe of CMFT Must Be Stopped that has Tech N9ne and Kid Bookie on it, which is just one of the most proudly dumb songs I think I've ever heard.
I think that song coming off the back of Home, which is this really kind of very saccharine, syrupy ballad I think if you can sit through that, then you can probably find some level of enjoyment from this record. If you can sit through those two songs back to back and not just be, just really roll your eyes into the back of your head, then I think you can probably get through this record. It's weird, isn't it? Because I really like and respect Corey Taylor. Slipknot are great, obviously. But it's not an exciting... To me, it's Corey Taylor going solo at this point in his career. I kind of feel like the ship has sailed a little bit. Like, I don't really know how exciting this is for anyone. And this thing about, you know, like, oh, it's a lot of fun that he had so much fun making this and getting it, you know, getting a load of music and the load of musicians that you respect together and having a load of fun with them. And I think that's all well and good, but it does sound like the sort of thing that maybe you should just invite some of your mates around and have a barbecue and make this music and just not
as long as like you're 45 plus and all your mates are 45 plus. It sounds like kind of like, I mean, it's really professionally recorded, but it does sound like basically John Mellencamp outtakes. Like, you know, I mean, the thing is, like, there's a lot of like really sort of like, you know, sort of like blues rock, like, but really middle of the road blues rock, really, you know, that kind of modern country where it's almost lost all the country aspects and it's become just there's something else. You know, the lyrics are really sort of cliched. You know, the rhyming couplets are just like, I must have heard those couplets, like, you know, walking down this road or whatever, you know, you can, it's almost like fridge poetry lyrics.
Mm.
And so I just, yeah, just wonder like how much investment is in it. I'm obviously he's invested in it in the sense that he's having a good laugh, but you can, whenever I hear thing about singer-songwriters albums, I imagine there's been some kind of element of self-reflection that's gone into it. And I'm kind of lacking any of that. There's no artistic voice in it other than he's got technically a really good voice.
Mm.
It feels like watching your neighbours have a party. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like your neighbours are having a party and they're all having a really great time.
Oh, they're all drinking Bud. They're all drinking Coors Light.
All you can hear is like a sort of indeterminate sort of bump, bump, bump from the music and loads of laughter. And you're like, I kind of... that's kind of catchy and I can hear that, but then it's like a bubble. As soon as it hits oxygen, it just pops and back. I hear these songs, they go in and you sort of find yourself going, this is pretty boring, but it's catchy, and then it finishes and I can't remember anything about it. And I just it's kind of nothing. I mean, like, considering it's such a big out, it's the first Corey Taylor solo album, it's kind of nothing, this record. I think it's kind of, I don't think songs are that well written. I don't think
it's all his influences are stuff that he might have got later in life. Like, it's all the influences are very like in the AOR middle of the road kind of thing, with a few sort of like punky tracks. When I say punky, I mean, you know, there's a little hint of it like on Mine Lux or whatever. But it's not, you can tell it, unless it's, he actually grew up listening to John Mellencamp and all those kind of like middle of the road things when he was, I thought he'd have gone for a few more formative influences.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the problem is that a lot of those are the kind of influences that he does put into Stone Sour and Slipknot. You know, if you actually dissect everything that goes into both Slipknot and Stone Sour's entire discography, you know, a lot of which is coming straight from Corey, you've got a pretty broad spectrum of stuff going on there already. So I'm not too surprised he's just kind of gone, fuck it. Like, I'm just going to have a laugh. And like, we interview him for this cover feature in this issue. And Danny Levers very masterfully basically said, loads of people are going to think this is shit. In kind of a nicer, a kind of, you know, not so antagonistic way. And Corey basically just went, yeah, I know. Like, he just clearly just is not putting this out, I don't think, for anyone but himself. And if people vibe with it, which some people clearly have, you know, as I said, Dave in the magazine really likes it, that's great too. It's a weird one. It doesn't feel like the kind of defining statement that a first solo album normally is. I mean, it's not exactly an uncommon thing for a solo album to not be anywhere near as good as the bands that it came from, but this album just is what it is. Corey Taylor's having a party. And you can be invited if you want, I guess, which is fine.
I'm washing my hair that night, unfortunately, Corey.
You're washing your hair?
It's just a bit, it's kind of just a sort of low-key, I don't know, a low-key vanity project, I guess, isn't it? Not even a vanity project, I guess, just like, it feels like it's been knocked out in about 3 minutes. But then this stuff's, I think also what we need to acknowledge is this shit is massive in America.
Yeah.
It's apps, and it's, you know, we're speaking three kind of anglophile, not angle grinding, three people. And there's really no comparative sort of big, you know, not many of those bands that are that massive, massive, massive bands, the kind of Godsmacks and the, you know, the
Three Shine Downs,
all that shit. Like, yeah, those, some of those bands are getting quite big over here, frustratingly. But it's absolutely huge in America, that stuff, isn't it? So I'm not really surprised that there's a lot of
It's very Heartlands America. Like, it seems more aimed at goth Brook fans than Slipknot fans.
Red State Rock, innit?
Yeah,
it's for Red State Rock.
Yeah.
So yeah. I mean, yeah, I think you probably
Bible belt bangers.
Sorry?
Bible belt bangers.
Bible belt bangers, sure.
Yeah, buy a big dog and then sign up for the Navy after you've seen the Corey Taylor show. That's what it's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can do that if you want.
Just get as far away from it as possible.
But yeah, I think that if you kind of heard the singles he's put out so far, you've probably got a good idea of what this album's all about. So it's out on Friday. Go dig into it if you fancy it. If you fancy something a little bit more in depth and complex and maybe representative of a band, you know, still doing what they do best, then you might want to also check out the new Enslaved album, Utzgard, which is out on Friday via Nuclear Blast. I mentioned earlier, we've got a big old streaming thing we're doing with them tomorrow from 7 p.m. And yeah, this is the, I think, the umpteenth Enslaved album.
Is it the 14th off the top of my head? I could be wrong.
Yeah, 14th it says here. Adam Rees gave this one a cracking 9 out of 10 review in the new issue of Metal Hammer. I mean, I was chatting to Steve about this album a little bit earlier on. Feels like Enslaved, they kind of went through a quite seismic shift a few albums ago, what you'd probably now call their mid-career era. And now it feels like they've kind of steadied into a more solid, progressive groove. And they're kind of continuing the journey that they've kind of been on for a little while now. Is that fair to say, Jonathan?
Yes and no. So, I mean, I think like their big shift was with Issa. And you could hear elements of it in the previous album, Below the Lights, of like realizing that song when Fire Swept Clean the Earth, this kind of new progressive thing coming out. And then Issa, when that came out, was just like, holy fuck. It was just like, they'd kind of taken this complete quantum leap into being something else. And the only parallel I can have with it is when Isis put out Oceanic. Like, you could hear all the things bubbling out, and then they suddenly became this totally complete thing. And so that was such a seismic shift. So trying to sort of work out where their center balance is since then, it's been interesting. So it's been, they've kind of journeyed on, and every album's kind of either been different or they've been in pairs. They've had a kind of a slightly different angle on them. But this one, I felt, is a bit more streamlined than the previous two. It took me a little while, like E and In Times. And we listen to those. There's so much going on in there. It's almost like it's all kind of taking you up to this kind of almost like ecstatic state. And that's amazing. But this one, like even though it's still really progressive and there's and the parts of the songs themselves, they're a bit more streamlined than the previous two albums. And so it's kind of got a bit more of an Issa feel. So, but that just means like the push and pull of like the sort of the black metal-y bits or the harsh bits and progressive bits, they feel that much more sort of in sharp relief. And then, they've got that one song, I'm trying to remember the name of it, it's about three quarters of the way through that suddenly goes totally krautrock rock or post-punk. So just throw all these weird things into the mix. But it feels like one of the most complete albums they've done for quite a while.
Mm. I like this. I like Enslaved. I think you're right to pick up on Issa and Rune, particularly with the two that, yeah. That I got into Enslaved on. I wasn't listening to black metal at all back in those days. And then hearing that, there was this whole more progressive bent that was happening in that scene from, be it from Gojira to Opeth to whoever, I was sort of quite heavily invested in a lot of those bands and was under the understanding that that was the kind of direction that Enslaved were going in that time. So I did go and sort of dig out those two albums and I really, really loved them. And since then, I've basically kind of been a every other album sort of Enslaved guy. I thought Ritir was really good. You mentioned E, which I've got on vinyl actually, and it sounds lovely on vinyl. But I always feel like at this point, I sort of know what I'm going to get. And I think with this first record, I mean, the first song, Fires in the Dark, it couldn't be more like if you said to someone, think of Enslaved and what they sound like, that is it. What you hear at the start of that song is exactly where my mind goes. So I think at this point, I think it's 15 albums in, by all accounts. This is a long, long career. And, I don't think they can carry on reinventing the wheel the whole time, but there's enough new stuff. And like the song you're talking about, that kind of joy, that Joy Division, Urjutun, I think it's called, which is a really, really great song. And I mean, obviously the influence of Joy Division on extreme metal has been fairly, has been talked about quite a lot over the years, but I'm not sure that I've ever heard it be quite as pronounced as it is on a, in the last couple of years. It feels like people are really, like, they're really leaning in on that, like you say, krautrock, post-punk thing. And I mean, Autocrati, I remember going to see Autocrati a couple
of years ago. One album, they kind of went back to doing what they normally did after that, but that was great. But yeah, I think ever since Beast Milk album came out, everyone was starting going post-punk, and you can still kind of hear all these new bands, all these older bands kind of taking that influence on.
Which is great. I love the sound of that stuff, and I really love that band, so I'm glad to hear it. I really like Enslaved. It's not my absolute favorite thing in the world, so how many albums of this sort of thing do I need? Because there's a couple of other bits in it, and because there are a couple of absolute rages on this album, I think this is a good record. I probably will listen to it again. And I think as well, Jonathan, you're right. I think when you're a kind of progressive band, showing kind of restraint and brevity in your music is quite an important thing to be able to do as well. And this is only like 41 minutes long, 40. No, it's 45 minutes long, 9 songs, 45 minutes. So it's not a, it's not a kind of a really difficult undertaking, this album. It's
no.
A thing where I think, I've never listened to Enslaved, would this be a good place to start? I'd probably say, yeah, it's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah. But what I also love about, I think why they've managed to be like also still feel really creative, 14 or 15 albums in, depending on which one of us people are going to believe. But they always like sound so open-ended. Like it's always feels like a journey without a destination. And always gets real kind of sense of just like welling up of hope coming out of the records and this one. And that, and and that last song, Distant Seasons, it's just so epic. And it just, I feel like when you're in a situation which actually does feel open-ended, but in a really grim way, like we are at the moment, like having a sense of like open-endedness and realizing that can be a positive thing, which is really what the dynamics of Enslaved are about. Of just like, you know, constantly seeing it ahead to the future and with a kind of anticipation. I think we really need that right now. And I think this album really does that. And I think this album feels very timely right now. Also, the theme of it is kind of going into your subconscious. It's like it talks about the realm of Utgard or Urjotun, depending on what you call it, which is the realm of the giants and the realm of chaos. It's also the realm of creativity. And that's also just like, stuck in isolation by ourselves. How to kind of, navigate this kind of uncertain times and get something creative out of it. So I think on a sonic level and a thematic level, I think it's really timely.
I think as well, if you want to kind of dig a lot deeper into those themes that Jonathan was just talking about, you really want to read his excellent interview with Ivar that's in the new issue of Metal Hammer that's out right now. They really go deep on all those themes, and it's a fascinating read for a very fascinating band. Utgard is also out this Friday on Nuclear Blast. And again, go check out that stream if you can tomorrow night from 7 p.m. All the details are on metalhammer.com. It's going to be bloody brilliant.
Can't bloody wait. Love that band.
Hell yeah. Let's do some reader questions, ladies and gents. Just gents. facebook.com/metalhammerreaders if you want to get stuck in and ask us some. Stash Renevich asks, as kids, did your parents ever disapprove of any records you brought home? That's a great question.
It is.
Yeah. My mum got upset that I was wearing a Satanist hoodie even a few years ago. She was actually fairly open-minded, but
what was the hoodie?
Behemoth, the Satanist. Just said the Satanist on it.
I thought you said a Satanist.
No. But I remember getting Evil Empire by Rage Against the Machine, and one of the sort of earlier, heavier records that I bought. And because she thought that everything to do with metal was about Satan and stuff. She was like, "Evil M, they're talking about Satan. They're talking about Satan." It's like, I was like, they're really not. I don't think the evil empire they're referring to is like Lucifer or anything. Do you know what I mean? So that took some explaining. But in the most, in the main, yeah, a few. When I got into like more like grindcore and stuff, I remember getting like agoraphobic nosebleeds, honky reduction, and like Prowling the Yard by Pig Destroyer. I think my mum at that point was like, when you like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, that was all right. But this feels like maybe a little bit too far down the line, to be honest.
Jonathan?
Well, when I was a kid, I wasn't really like a super metalhead when I was a kid. So I was, you know, I was probably like in the 80s. So my mother was actually pretty open-minded and I could always talk to her about music. My dad was a music fan, but he's a jazz fan. He didn't really sort of get a lot of stuff I might have been into. But do you remember Fuzzbox? A band called Fuzzbox. So originally called We've Got a Fuzzbox and We're Going to Use It. And they're like a kind of an all-female indie band I was really into. And they're on top of the Pops and they're doing some weird, trippy version of Spirit in the Sky. I remember me and my sister were watching it and my mum told us to turn it off because she was so horrified by this kind of weird wonkiness of it. And then they became Fuzzbox, became a bit of a pop band. And so there's that. I imagine when I keep going banging on about this band, but when I was 16 and I bought Holy Money by Swans and I put that on. I mean, I disapproved of it. I just bought it on spec. I just saw reviews saying made it sound like the most horrific record in the world. And I'd go down to Camden, buy records, and put it back on my dad's turntable. And I disapproved of it. I just couldn't believe it, what the fuck I was hearing. So, I think by the time I was into metal, I'd kind of moved out home. So, but yeah, sometimes strange things that I remember putting on Scary Monsters and, you know, the opening of Scary Monsters. And it's got all those weird sort of scratchy sounds. And I was in my dad's turntable, he thought I was ruining the turntable. And I remember like listening to French Kiss by Lil Louis. Which I was in Virgin Megastore. This is aging it. And I just heard it and I thought, right, I'm buying it straight away. It's just like that. That's exactly what I was into, that kind of post I Fear Love, super sequence stuff. So I remember putting that on and all the ooze started coming in. And so my dad came into the house and he was like, what the fuck is this? You know, like all these sort of orgasmic ooze.
Orgasmic ooze.
So as far as metal's concerned, I think I'd moved out long before, you know, by the time I was into metal.
That's fair. I mean, my parents, neither of them were into metal, and I think my dad maybe thought it was a bit noisy. I think he said that he had Paranoid by Black Sabbath when he was a kid, so he kind of got it. But my mum didn't really mind that much. The thing is, she grew up listening to like T-Rex and David Bowie and stuff like that. And she could, you know, when I started listening to like Marilyn Manson, she could just see my mum's always said Marilyn Manson's just a knockoff David Bowie. So like, I think even when I was trying to be like, oh yeah, I'm walking around in my like Slipknot hoodie and blah, 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 I just don't think she took it very seriously. There was certainly no kind of like, being scared of it or any of that shit, because she was there for that stuff all the first time round. But I do remember that when I did start listening to Manson and I started listening to albums like Mechanical Animals, I do remember her saying, well, it's definitely better than like when I was listening to like Linkin Park and Limp Bizkit, that kind of like more like dumbass end of, not that I'd say that about Linkin Park, but that more kind of dumbass end of nu metal. I think she was quite relieved that I gravitated to kind of more musically commendable music, if anything.
Oh yeah, I have a grandmother and Marilyn Manson story actually. So in 96 for Metal Hammer, when I was freelancing for Metal Hammer, I went to New York and interviewed Marilyn Manson. And I came back and I told my grandmother that I had the cover story of a magazine of this Metal Hammer. And she's like, oh, next time you come around, bring it over. I'm just like, oh my God. So this is Manson in his prime.
Yeah.
And my grandmother, she's like 91, 92 at the time. So still sharp as flint. And so next time round, I bought a copy of the magazine, showed it, like handed it to her, just like bracing myself. And imagine like the late Ruth, she's much like the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's this kind of tiny little woman, just like still super sharp and hunched over this magazine, flicking through it. She's flicking through it. It's like looking down on it, peering over glasses. She looks up, she goes like, "I've seen worse." What? Where have you, you're 92, where have you seen worse?
Yeah, well, being 92, like,
yeah, probably, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I just, I was, that was not the response I was expecting. I thought she'd be more shocked. Although she'd call me up the next day and she'd read it and goes, "Jonathan, this is pornography."
She wasn't looking at the old classifiers in the back, was she?
Yeah, she might have been actually. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? I'm sorry. Yeah. Do with that. I was not there in that era.
Fair in those days, wasn't it? Just a better magazine back in those things.
Yeah, definitely. It was a different time. But my grandma actually sewed Slipknot patches onto my jeans, so I did a terrible job with scaring all my relatives about with my music taste. I didn't give a shit. Never mind. Let's do the next question. Would you like to read it out, Steve?
Yeah. Ever said you will get into a band but never had the time to dig into the back catalogue? From Gal Gayonia. Galonia. Sorry, Gal. Quite a few, I think. I'm not sure there's that many in metal. The big one for me, and Jonathan is going to probably like do a massive like wow at this, but Kraftwerk is a big blot in my. I should listen. I don't know enough about Kraftwerk.
Well, I will say that the first two records are very different. Like Kraftwerk 1 and 2 mm-hmm. are very different from the classics, and mostly unlistenable. But it's interesting. Kraftwerk at one point had a flute.
Did they? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Say that again. You went a bit bloopy.
So in the early days of Kraftwerk, they had a flute. But also if there's no Kraftwerk, there'd be no electro. The influence it had on the, especially on the East Coast rap scene, was immense. I was so, back in the 80s, I was so obsessed with electro and like Afrika Bambaataa. There's really sort of, Mantronics, they're kind of in between electro and rap. But that whole period, I was obsessed with it. And it all stems from Kraftwerk. One of the three elemental bands. So, yes, you should. But there's one listenable track on Kraftwerk 1, I think, and which is amazing. And the rest of it is just this kind of like you get on a lot of. Crack rock records, you get absolute bangers, but you get this whole continent or seas, oceans of kind of really avant-garde, not really listenable stuff, and then suddenly Hallelujah or kind of it. But the four Kraftwerk albums, the ones after the first two, that everyone's just like, it's just perfection basically.
Yeah, I should do that. I mean, and for a more metal answer, since this is a predominantly metal podcast, I would have to say my knowledge of black metal is really kind of most of the big bands, but I don't really know very much about Gorgoroth as well. I've always sort of thought, because they were like, there's that period where they were super evil, the most evil thing, and I was like, I'll give that a go, and I never really went fully in on Gorgoroth. So again, Jonathan will probably be able to point me in the correct direction for Gorgoroth, but yeah, they'd be the two sort of main ones, I reckon.
Yeah.
My knowledge of black metal is not spectacular either. Mine's pretty surface level as well, I'd say. I mean, but in terms of like the kind of the great legendary rock, pop, whatever bands, I've got so many. I mean, me and Steve have talked about U2 before. Steve sent me a U2 album. I've heard U2's greatest hits, but I've never really dug into them. Steve's helped me out a little bit on that. Pink Floyd is one massive one that I've just kind of said for years upon years upon years. At some point, I'm going to like do Pink Floyd and I'm going to go all in, but I just kind of keep putting it off. Now I know, but I just never find myself in the mood for it.
I really like the Syd Barrett era, but I love Animals. It's just such an amazing record.
The Wolves probably potentially might be my favorite album ever. I love The Wall. I know it's fucking, massive, and it'd be like picking that and Dark Side of the Moon are the big two. Animals is amazing, but that run of four The Kind of Animals, The Wall, Wish You Were Here, Dark Side of the Moon, those four, I just think are pretty much as good as music gets in a run of four, really. Amazing.
Yeah.
I can take or leave the Syd Barrett era, Jonathan.
I mean, I like Red. I love Red.
Piper at the Gates of Dawn was like the third Pink Floyd album I got, and it was a big old shock to me back then. So it took a lot of like getting my head around it. And when you say you're not in the mood, I mean, I think actually, not that I would, I mean, I wouldn't be the person to recommend you Syd Barrett era stuff, but you know, they're a lot more, they're not quite as serious as people make out in that those early years, I don't think. I think they've got there's a bit more sort of humour and sort of silliness to them that I think gets a bit lost by people who slag them off and think they're this kind of super serious, po-faced muso band.
Interesting.
Well, it was great. It was being at school when Brick in the Wall was number one. We don't need new education. We just sing that with all our teachers.
Yeah, I bet.
That showed him.
Yeah.
What about you, Jonathan? Do you have any
I mean, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but one thing, and I still haven't got around to doing it, is like on the non-metal side is Tom Waits. Just because he hasn't really clicked with me in the way I know he should. I mean, so there's a lot of bands, there's a lot of on the non-metal things where just like I would go back through them, not piecemeal, like Captain Beefheart or Tim Buckley, because I was so obsessed with Star Sailor, the record, which is one of the most out there records you've ever heard, Father of Jeff Buckley. Mm-hmm. On a metal thing, but you know what, in some ways I'm kind of with you on the black metal thing. So sometimes I just feel right, I'm gonna just like, not that, because obviously I know the records, but I kind of go, I want to go through them like in kind of chronological order, like basically go through Dial's book, Evolution of the Cult, which is probably the authoritative history of black metal, and pick a band like Rotten Christ or some other, like, you know, there was lots of like underground bands like from the French scene that I wanted to probably listen to. Just pick a band and go, right, let's go through them in all chronological order and spend a day going through and see how that developed. And then so I still kind of wanted to sometimes just go, right, let's do this in a really methodical way and see how that kind of how I get to reassess everything.
Interesting. I would like to kind of see you do that and write about it or talk about it. Ben Wilmer asks, possibly Two Town Beat to be read out. No, it isn't. We're going with it. But what state do you think our live music industry will be in by the time COVID is over or declining? How big a list of casualties of live music venues closing and bands having to get better paid jobs do you think is likely? So how fucked is everything once all this is over, basically?
I mean, it is. I can understand why Ben thinks that's a depressing subject. I mean, he said maybe a bit too morbid to read out. How do you envisage your death? That would have been too morbid to read out. But in terms of the question, I mean, yeah, I think we're going to see some real. I mean, we talked about Anathema last week, and that is, they're probably so far, I would say, the most high profile band. I think, as we said, they're the most high profile band to quit and give the reasons, or go on hiatus and give the reasons to do with the situation that's happening at the moment with COVID. But I mean, I think it's a long road, and I think we're going to lose a lot of venues. We're going to lose a lot of bands. And yeah, I think it's going to, it's pretty bleak, isn't it? Like, the whole thing is obviously, I think it's kind of obvious to say it's bleak. And I don't really see, I think the kind of frustrating thing, it's a frustrating thing, is that I can't see an end to it.
Well, the pandemic?
Well, no, just what happens. I mean, I can't, at the moment, you don't know when things are going to go fully back to normal. And then even when they do, you don't know how much of the touring, the sort of structure of tours, how badly they will be affected for touring to just still not be able to happen straight away. Anyway, I mean, I was talking to someone who was saying the problem is, even when you get the go ahead to book tours, like for American bands, a lot of them, when they go to think about touring Europe, some of the venues that they would usually tour will be shut down, which means that the route that they would usually take through Europe, they might not be able to take. And you just take a couple of dates out of that massive European tour, and suddenly they're losing money, and suddenly it's not worth them doing it. So if you just got to lose a couple of venues here and there, and then you might lose a complete tour. And if you lose a complete tour, you might lose a complete band. And then that's the band and their label and their, you know, their crew, and everyone are just without any source of income. It's even when you think about it on a very surface level, it's depressing. But when you really think about it,
there's so much infrastructure that's hard to put back together. You can't just put that back together again straight immediately.
No, you can't. And you know, it's scary. We're seeing, you know, we've talked about the Crowbar going down, various venues having to close permanently. Now we're seeing bands having to tie stuff together. I mean, obviously in the UK, unfortunately, we've got the spectre of Brexit hanging over all this as well, which is going to doubly fuck a lot of touring artists, unfortunately. A lot of people don't like to hear that, but it's true. You know, stuff is going to be pretty fucked for a while. There's no doubt about it. But I think it is also important to remember that I think when you're in the midst of just globe altering events, it's easy to kind of feel like it's the end times and this is the kind of road to ruin. But, you know, things do always come back around again. Like we will have, you know, this pandemic will be over at some point. Things like, you know, they're already talking about instant testing or kind of, you know, minutes long testing processes being introduced. That's going to make such a big difference in terms of being able to do live shows and various other public things. And eventually at the end of this, the pandemic will be over and then it is going to be a hard road to get back to normality. But, you know, something will come back out of the ashes again, because it always does. This isn't the first time that the arts have been faced with catastrophic change on a global level at all. So it's going to be a pain barrier out there, but you know, there's a lot of encouraging signs of bands in the industry evolving, and there are signs out there that we're closer to the end of this fucking madness than we might think, although I know it doesn't sound like it right now. But there's big changes that can make significant changes in the long run as well. Like, you know, at some point hopefully we'll get a government in that actually seems to want to support the arts a bit better. I think, you know, changes like that can make all the difference. So
just getting a working test and trace system would be good.
Yeah, there's loads of stuff. I mean, we could go on many tangential rants here, but there's a lot of shit going on right now, and not all those things are going to be shit forever. Like, regimes will change, processes will change, the pandemic will end at some point and it will all come back round again. And in the meantime, we just got to keep on supporting bands in, and, you know, other people in the industry however we can. So if you see like petitions going around, sign them. If you feel like you can safely join demonstrations, then join them, obviously masked and socially distanced. You know, just keeping an eye out for ways to support everybody, because that's what we all need to do, because that's what it's all about. And we'll come out the other end of this somehow. In more authoritarian terms, Jonathan, do you want to take the next question?
Scott Sitomple asks, if you were given the power to rule London for a day, what would you do?
Well, I mean, to key into something I just said, I'd probably try and put immediate pressure on the government to support the arts a bit better. That's one thing. I know it's a bit specific, but I'd be like, let's fucking, come on, need this shit, let's go.
I'd smash that fucking Tottenham Court Road shithole down that I was talking about last week. Smash that bloody Starbucks down. Smash that Olympic, whatever, Queen Elizabeth line down. And I'd build the Astoria 2.0. Obviously, probably not in a day. I reckon
10 times.
Yeah, I reckon I could definitely smash those two Starbucks to pieces in a day. That's for sure, with enough helping hands. But I'd get that signed up and ready and done. And I'd be getting up early in the morning and I'd be getting the bloody digger out by 9 a.m. breakfast time for the digger to smash that shit all up and get the...
And the LA 2.
Yeah, and the LA 2 and the 12 bar and all that stuff that we were talking about last week. I get all that back. And I mean, I don't know, I'd give everyone a Krispy Kreme as well. That'd be a nice thing to do, wouldn't it? I'm very like, smash it up and give people sort of sweet pastry treats. Very much my my vote hill.
I mean, that sounds like a potentially reckless use of taxpayers' money, mate. I'm not going to lie.
It's only a day, isn't it?
Slash a very cynical marketing move.
Yeah, it is only 24 hours. So I think, you know.
Good point. If
you've got a 24-hour budget, then you...
So 24 hours, Steve has set back London's kind of economic advance 10 years and given everyone diabetes.
Of one donut? Come on. Who's getting rid of diabetes off of one donut?
Well, yeah, I'll probably be a bit about it. Jonathan, what would you do?
Well, assuming that we're not really talking within the realms of actual possibility here, I'd basically make everything you ever, like, all your TV or your radio, basically I'd make it like you could only listen to weird 70s and 80s stuff. So that's the only thing you could actually partake in, because, like, I play 80s stuff, 80s pop music now to people who didn't grow up in the era, and from them it's like it's from another world. And I just miss the days when everything was like pop stars were like interplanetary creatures. Everything was kind of a bit surreal. Like, I grew up in a world, I don't know if you know Oh Superman by Laurie Anderson, when that was number two in the charts. Imagine a world where that song that goes for 8 minutes and 21 seconds is number two. And yet it's really affecting the song, and people got it back then. So I would just basically find some way to introduce a kind of a surrealism into everyone's lives for a bit and broaden everyone's minds by going like, what the fuck is this? But this was part of our world back then. So not really within the realms of possibility, but just neither's me rolling London for a day, sadly.
Like, someone would hijack that and they'd be playing fucking Chesney Hawks within minutes. They'd get the old 80s retro.
I would roar the airwaves with a fist of iron. No, it would be like loads of like hazy and yeah, weird and Monsoon and The Associates and weird 80s pop.
That's some weirdly weird inverse kind of dystopian shit going on there. No, everyone has to listen to 70s.
All weird 70s children's programs and 80s children's programs that will just rewire your brain. And I just think we live in a very sort of rational world these days. And I long for the days where people could handle a bit more sort of, you know, general surrealism was part of your everyday consciousness. And I would find ways to reintroduce that.
What was the name of that show that was in the 70s, that kids show, Tib Tabs, or like the puppets, the like animal?
Pip.
Yeah.
With hardly a hair.
Yeah.
Wait, what was it? You both kept talking over each other. I couldn't hear it.
Pipkins with Hartley Hare, which is the most disturbing children's TV character you'll ever come across.
Pipkins?
Yeah. If you put YouTube, Pipkins, Hartley Hare, as in the animal, be naughty, it's generally the most disturbing rank shit you've ever come across.
Terrifying. Oh, my God.
It's like kind of 70s soak, you know, that it was hang out in bars and just all day, was like his soul trapped in the body of this kind of really tatty hair, like
fuck
puppet
me
hair.
this looks terrifying.
I don't remember it at all, but I saw a clip of it on a Charlie Brooker show, and there's a bit where somebody is like, the rabbit's aunt died or something, and they're talking to him about death, like explaining death to him. It's fucking mental.
The bit where he's basically like, goes like, do you like being naughty? And then he ends up walking around humping a jack-in-the-box.
What, man? I mean, I'd love to know what kind of drugs TV like kids' TV show creators used to play.
The most surreal kids program ever was in the 90s, and it was on ITV. It's like their version of Teletubbies, and it's called Pooh Bar or something. And it's literally the most psychedelic thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Pooh Bar.
Yeah, something that might not be the name, but it was on ITV. It was their answer to
I think I know what you're talking about. Actually,
those eyebrows that lit up and these strange. And it was literally the trippiest thing I've ever seen on TV ever. And that was in the 90s. So,
all right. Well, let's do one more question before we fall down a psychedelic kids' TV puppet hole. Alistair Belling says, What songwriting techniques do you want to hear more of in the coming years on the metal front? Personally, I think the acoustic guitar gets left out of the party far too often, except when Mastodon put it out for some extra rhythm action. That's what we want for metal. Just go up to Gojira and go, hold on, guys. I know what's going to get this party going.
Gojira featuring Ed Sheeran.
I'm sure that's not what Alistair means. But no. Yeah, I don't know, really. I saw this question and I think it's a very good question, but I just kind of thought just more bands taking risks and doing whatever the fuck they want, you know, and just not really like my favourite metal albums from this year. Maybe not counting the Trivium one, but that's because it's Trivium and it's kind of their sound they've established. Most of my favourite albums this year haven't really sounded like anything else that's going on right now. Code Orange, Oceans of Slumber, A.A. Williams. You know, these are albums that don't have direct and obvious kind of peers, I don't think. It's like, keep on doing your own things, lads.
I would very much, as we've spoken a lot, Mel, between the two of us, as a fan of that kind of experimental alternative hip-hop thing which is going on at the moment, which feels like I think pretty much the most sort of exciting cutting edge thing happening in music at the moment. I would like to see more of those bands, more bands who are kind of relatable to that thing, maybe not copying it or being part of it, but at least kind of associate themselves with those sort of bands. I said to like Code Orange with Clipping and Backwash as a tour would be just such a wicked thing. And, you know, I know how much, like, I think that's something which I've said it a bunch of times, but it sort of gets lost with Code Orange is, you know, the influence they've taken from stuff like Injury Reserve is like, or JPEG Mafia is like massive. And that stuff's like, that stuff's weird as fuck as well. Like what Jonathan's saying about, you know, these kind of the linear world we live in, those artists are not that at all. And I think metal could definitely, while maybe not stylistically and actually kind of straight ahead borrowing from that sound, that approach I think would be really, really cool to see more commonplace like it used
would,
to.
Would listen. What about you, Sals?
Well, so one thing that has been nice coming back in a little bit, well, I say back in, I don't know if it's how long it's been in there for, there's been some interesting brass in metal recently, like Sun, Imperial Trumpet. But the thing that most I'd like to see more of that kind of relates to what you're saying, but maybe a different way, is repetition. You know, we're talking about Kraftwerk and Krautrock, like how mesmerizing repetition can be if you have the nerve to hold on to it. So obviously you get that a lot with Around Pazuzu, but yeah, just the mesmerizing psychedelic, and you get it with Heilung and in different ways, Wadruna, but yeah, just the mesmerizing effect of repetition and holding on your nerve and just playing the same riff over and over again until something magical happens and your brain bursts. And I'd like to see kind of, yeah, more people playing with that. And with, yeah, those kind of like ritual strokes, psychological techniques of repetition, basically.
Nice. Wonderful answers, one and all. I think that's just about it for this week's show. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for joining me, lads. The show will be back next week. Pick up that latest issue of Mel Hammer. Go check out that very cool Enslaved stream. And watch out for those Corey Taylor bundles that are on the way, as I mentioned earlier. In the meantime, stay safe, stay positive out there. We've got a lot of new music that's carrying us through all this nightmare. So keep playing it loud and keep looking after each other. In the meantime, we'll see you all very soon. Goodbye, everybody.
Till next time.
See ya.
Bye.
Very well staggered. Well done.